Okay, so I think some of you saw I posted the exam solutions sometime over the weekend, I think it was, maybe even Friday. Should have those back to you by Thursday. That's what I'm shooting for. So hopefully, haven't looked at them at all, actually. So can't even tell you how it's going so far. But we'll try to get them through by Thursday so you can get them back. Today we're going to keep talking about this input shaping idea. We are going to have a lab, actually touch some hardware finally. So look for an email about that. It'll be in Teams using a cable-driven parallel manipulator we have down in my lab. So what we'll do is you'll sign up for basically a time slot on a Google Calendar type thing. You and your team will come, get to drive the thing around, do some of this input shaping stuff on that system, see how it works, get some data, and then report on your findings. So today we'll get through the input shaping stuff you'll need for that lab in terms of how to design these input shapers. Okay. So we started talking a week ago, I guess, before the exam, about this idea of input shaping, where what we want to do is come up with some way or some intelligent way to think about what command we're actually issuing to the system. And we haven't done that so far really in the semester until this point. We've assumed that we have these test commands, steps and ramps and parabolas and all that kind of thing. But it turns out that, hey, what you're asking the machine can do has a lot of effect on how it's performing. Right? That makes intuitive sense. I think most undergraduate textbooks do a poor job kind of getting that point across. Right? You have control over what you're asking the machine to do. So that's another area where you can make some design choices. And input shaping is one way we're going to make that choice. So if I take some original reference command shown here is this red dashed line, and what we said was, hey, I can take and convolve this with a sequence of impulses. And we said, well, let's let this impulse sequence have a form something like this. And we actually said, well, as we'll see, we pretty much always want to be the case where that T1 is 0. And this convolution process will result in a new command that looks like what?
It's the step of amplitude A1, and then a straight horizontal line, and then another step.
How long is the horizontal line?
T2.
Right. So to get to that, just to refresh our memories, we take the original reference command, multiply by A1, and delay it by time T1, which in this case would be 0. So if this is starting at 0, then our new shape command would start at this time, stat time. So we're still starting at 0. So you can take the original command, multiply by A1, and do it at that time. Right? Then we take the original command, multiply by A2, but do it at this time plus T2. Okay, so the A2 command doesn't start being applied until time T2. Look right, yeah. Then once we have those two pieces of the command, we just add them together. Okay, there's an image in the notes from Tuesday. So the command ends up looking something like that, where this amplitude. And then you can look at this little piece here. The size of that is A2. Right. And if I design that correctly, then I get a response that looks like that, something like that. Okay. And we call this red thing down here, after we've done the convolution, we would call that the shaped command because it has had an input shaper applied to it, right? And then the blue, we would say, hey, that's the shaped response. So it's a response to the input shape command. An input shaper by itself doesn't have a response. That's a common mistake for folks that are learning this, even in my research group. The response of the input shaper. The input shaper doesn't have a response. Systems have responses to an input shape command. All right. Okay, so that's the kind of general process, right? And we talked through really what's happening is you're creating some vibration with the second impulse that kind of cancels out the vibration from the first one. Or if you're down at this command, the vibration from the second step kind of cancels out the vibration from the first step. Right? And then we have, you know, once both of those are issued, we have no vibration. This works, I think we talked through, basically like noise-canceling headphones. Work pretty much the same way. Right? Noise-canceling headphones are listening to what's going on around the environment outside of you and play noise in the headphones. They're exactly out of phase with that. So that's kind of what's happening here. You have some vibration, and you create some additional vibration that's exactly out of phase, so they cancel. Right? We're just doing it in mechanical systems. So then the question comes up, well, how do I design these impulse sequences? Okay, so let's talk through that. No, noise—that's noise isolating headphones. I would say noise canceling are the active headphones. They're listening to what's going on in the environment around you, and they play the exact opposite sound. Of course, correcting for your ear dynamics and all that kind of stuff. But they play exactly out of phase. So if you know if the environment is doing this, your headphone hears that and plays this. And they're canceled.
So it ends up being no sound at all.
No sound from the environment. And you can't do it perfectly because you know your ears have transfer function. There's actually a transfer function for your head, that how your sound transmits through your head that's difficult to calculate. So that's why none of them are perfect. I can't answer that question for you. You got to make that choice for yourself. I have a pair that I love on the airplane, so I'd rather not, I guess, wear earplugs on the airplane. Okay, so let's look back at our impulse sequence and how can we design this thing. All right. Well, what I want to do is look at just the sequence, the impulse sequence. If maybe you remember a week ago, we talked that this convolution, one of its properties is it kind of passes along the vibration properties of this impulse sequence to this final command. Right? So if we can design this impulse sequence such that it would excite low vibration if we could give it straight to a system. Right? We can't really usually give impulses, right? It's not how we drive our system around. But we can use that mathematically to help us find a solution. And actually, I'm going to save this little piece of it, but you can write and actually look up in most vibrations and controls textbook, I forget whether yours has it or not, the impulse response of a second order oscillatory system. We know that in closed form. We can solve that differential equation. Right. And if you take, and if we have a linear system, then we have the impulse response to the first one, and we can solve the impulse response to the second one, and then what's the total impulse, the total response from that series of impulses? If superposition holds, the total response, and we know the response to A1, and we know the response to A2, and we know the response to AN, if we had more impulses, then the total response to that impulse sequence is just the sum of each of those, right? Superposition. Right? So we can write that, I'm going to call it the sum of this impulse sequence. Let's see, how do I want to write that? Okay, so it's going to look something like that. I'll explain each one of these terms. Inside here is actually an impulse sequence as well, or a summation. Explain terms in just a second. Okay? So we have this equation that represents the vibration of a second order harmonic oscillator. So it's our normal equation, right? S squared plus 2z omega n s plus omega n squared. Response of that type system to a sequence of impulses, sequence of n impulses. When the natural frequency is omega, damping ratio is zeta, and AI is the ith impulse amplitude. And TI is the ith impulse time. All right, so in this case, we have just A1, A2, T1, T2 that represent this guy. But we could have more than that. Okay, so I have vibration here. What I'd like to be able to get to is a kind of normalized version of this equation. We see we have this amplitude is going to depend on, the amplitude itself depends on both the natural frequency and damping ratio up front here. We'd like to get rid of that scaling term if we can. So let's look, maybe we can do that. And I want to look at what's this amplitude for a unity magnitude impulse at time zero. Okay. So unity magnitude impulse at time zero. So we only have one impulse, right? So Tn is zero, that part's one, right? So we can get rid of that. Time zero. This sine term is 0, so that goes away. Times 0, that's a 1. That's a 0, so I have just the impulse amplitude, which is 1 times what's out front here. So again, that's the response to a unity magnitude impulse at time 0. So it's given us a way to normalize this equation. So then we're going to write that equation. That's actually, take the vibration from our sequence of impulses and normalize it by that response to a single impulse. So we get kind of a normalized representation of the vibratory amplitude from the sequence of impulses. Okay. So go ahead and box that one. That is a core equation for this input shaping stuff. Okay. But that's what's going to tell us. That equation tells us how much vibration at a given frequency and damping ratio a sequence of impulses would create. So vibration from that sequence of impulses divided by a single unit magnitude impulse at time zero. Okay. So this gives us, and I should note also that this is a representation of what we call residual vibration. So this is assuming that the impulse sequence is finished. It's not saying anything about what would happen between T1 and T2. Okay. The whole sequence has been applied. Okay. Of course, we could look at what happens between T1 and T2 by just looking at the T1 response until time T2 and then add that way. So we can play some tricks, but this equation describes the whole sequence. Right. It doesn't tell us anything about transient vibration, stuff that's happening during the move. So if I have this equation, obviously we're going through it for some reason, how could I use this to design a shaper, or design this impulse sequence?
So if you know your residual vibration of the system without a shape command,
Okay. So what's my objective? My objective is to design this impulse sequence to limit vibration. I have some equation that describes vibration. So what should I do? So I could set it to equal to zero. If I really want, I want to say I want zero vibration, right? I could set it to equal to zero. So that's one possible thing. I think more generally, from this equation, so we can have some kind of constraint on vibration that's part of our solution process. So we take that vibration equation and set it less than or equal to some tolerable level of vibration, Vtol. And that tolerable level of vibration is this kind of normalized vibration. Right? So it's kind of a representation of how much we want to reduce the vibration. So if we say that's 5%, then what we're saying is that we want this impulse sequence to excite 5%, only 5% of the vibration that would be excited by one impulse. You need magnitude impulse at time t1. Okay. And then, yes, in some cases we might say Vtol is zero. And that's actually the case we're going to look at right now. Okay. So, if we say, hey, let I set that to zero. How many solutions do I have? I have to solve for AI and TI. How many solutions are there to that equation? I'm solving for AI and TI. Right?
You have N solutions.
Well, I have N impulses. Even for a given number of impulses, how many solutions do I have? These two, what's the kind of characteristic of these sine functions?
You have complex solutions, right?
Complex solutions, not necessarily. You can get real solutions. Let's think about it from the response. So last time we drew up, let's just pick an A1 right now, all right? So I pick A1. And let's assume we don't have any damping. That should be symmetric about that horizontal line. It's not, sorry. Okay? So there's A1 and the vibration that A1 creates. Okay? Well, how big does A2 need to be in this case if we don't have any damping? So we know in this case that A2 would have to be the same size. Okay, that's fine. We've limited it down some kind of thing. When can A2 happen?
It has to happen where it crosses the axis, right?
So tell me. Here or there?
The first time it crosses
there. First time? Okay, so that's a possible solution. And that would create, assuming the system's linear. Okay. Is there anywhere else I could apply an impulse and get zero vibration?
Could you apply it anywhere it crosses the axis?
I could go over here. Right. So I could pick that for A2 if I wanted. Right. So these are possible. Yeah, that's kind of implied a little bit here. Yeah. We'll get to that in just a second. So possible solutions are there? Infinitely many solutions to this. So the vibration equation alone is not enough to get me to an answer. Okay. So which one of those, of even those two choices, which one would I want to choose?
The one that minimizes time.
I want the fastest one. I want a fast response, right? So we can write that generally by saying, hey, I want to minimize the time of the last impulse, which is Tn in this case. Okay? So there's all this infinitely many solutions out there. I want the fastest one. Give me the shortest duration impulse sequence that would satisfy my vibration constraint. Okay? So that's cool. That gets us part of the way there. So we artificially limited kind of A1 and A2 in this case. What other constraints do I need? We kind of talked through one last time. We kind of have one implied here. Yeah, so we also have a constraint. I'll write that more generally. The sum of all the impulses sequence of impulses, the impulse amplitudes, have to sum together to equal 1. What does that do for me?
Makes your shaped response equal your unshaped response.
Right. It ensures that you're not causing any like extra vibration. So like you're not exciting.
Make sure your command gets you to the same place that you're...
That's the way to think about it, right? So this, if we're satisfying this constraint, we could have A equals 15, the sum of the impulses equal 15. If we satisfy this constraint, we have zero residual vibration. But what A summing that 1 does is make sure we get to the same final point as the unshaped command did. Right, so if this is position, the impulse is summing to 1, make sure we get to the same final position. If this is a velocity command, make sure we get to the same final velocity after we apply the input shape. So that constraint you can think the same value or same steady state value of your command, if you will. There's another way to think about that. You also think about that, make sure the DC gain of our filter is 1. If you want to think in those terms. Okay. What other constraint have we kind of implicitly applied so far? What have we said about the impulse amplitudes? So we said they have to sum to 1. In this case, are there any negative impulses so far? These are all positive impulses. So I'm going to have so we're constraining all the impulses to be positive right now. We'll see a little bit later we can actually have negative impulses if we want, and there's some benefit to doing that. But for now, let's just make sure they're all positive. So those two constraints together, what can we immediately say about any impulse in this sequence? Yeah, it's between 0 and 1. Okay. So, if we want to write this in kind of more formal optimization form, right, I have an objective to minimize the time of the last impulse. Subject 2. Those constraints. Okay. There are also some constraints here that apply that you wouldn't see in a theoretical formulation of this. But if we actually wanted to sit down and solve this, and write it into some Python, write a Python script to solve this set of equations, that we need to enforce. One was what you brought up earlier, which was, hey, A2 can't happen before A1, right? So what we're saying is, hey, the time of the I plus 1 impulse is greater than the ith impulse, time of the ith impulse. And And that's saying, hey, A2 happens after A1. A3 has to happen after A2. Right? And if you don't enforce this in your numerical solution of this guy, then it's going to place the impulses. Your computer doesn't care. Right? It's doing exactly what it told. It's solving that, and you haven't given it a constraint on the ordering of things. Okay? There's also another implied constraint. If we want the fastest solution, we pretty much know that T1 should be 0. There we go. So a couple implied constraints, if you will, that we would need if we were actually implementing the numerical solution of this. Okay. Let's look at this in a little bit more detail. Vibration, vibe. Okay. So we have a kind of high-level constraint set to solve for a shaper that would create zero vibration. Let's look at a little bit more detail at this vibration equation. Okay, and if we set that equal to 0, what has to happen for that equation to be 0? Yeah, both of those internal terms have to be 0. Right, for this to be 0, that's got to be 0, this has got to be 0. Okay. Let's write those out. Let's do this for a two-impulse sequence. So let's step through each of these guys. So we're minimizing T2 is our objective, right? Some of the impulses have to be 1, so we know that A1 plus A2 must be 1. Satisfy that guy. We know that that has to be true to satisfy that third constraint. And then we're going to work on the fourth one. And we also have our implied constraints. So we have those constraints there as well. And then so let's look at that vibration equation for this case. Okay. So we can look at the cosine term. And let's fill out the terms. So for A1, okay, for A1, we're saying, hey, that T1 is 0, right? So the exponential term goes to 1, goes to 1. This guy's 0, that term goes to 1. So the A1 term of this summation is just A1. Right, everybody follow me? The A2 term just plug in the values for A2 and you get that. All right. And we need that, we need that to be 0. For that vibration to always be 0. Okay, let's look at the sine term for this two impulse sequence. Well, for the first impulse, what's the it's going to be 0 because we have a 0 inside the sine, right? So that's 0, that gets rid of the whole thing. And then A2. We want that to be zero. Okay. When is that sine term zero? Okay, so we need, that's one possible solution. You know, omega d t2 to be what for that sine to go to zero? Can be zero.
Or pi.
Or pi, or,
yeah.
Yeah, there we go. So it can be, and we're not going to use n because we have n floating around for the impulses. Let's say p pi, pumpkin pie. All right, so, we can write then okay, if we want to choose, however, the fastest impulse sequence, what do we want p to be?
The first instance.
Yeah, the first time that happens. Okay, we found t2. Well, what is pi over omega d? Let's also, we can write that as the damped period divided by 2. So we found T2. We already had T1. Okay. So here are two times. Excuse me. I can take now my time here, plug him in there, and what we'll find, I'll save you the math for that, right? So we also know, so we're going to take T2 we found, plug in for T2, and we're also going to solve this guy and write A2 as 1 minus A1. Plug those into this equation, and what you find is that A1 is that. And then we know that capital K is the same as we defined for A1. Now we define a two-impulse sequence that has that form. So what you'll see is these impulse shapers are often written this way. And what we're saying is everything in this row of the matrix we're about to write is impulse amplitudes. Everything in the second row are the times. Where k is that exponential term up in the corner. So there we have a two-impulse sequence that creates zero vibration if we... for the omega d that we're looking, or the omega d we're looking at. All right. This guy, this sequence, is a zero vibration or ZV shaper. And that's one of the ones we know in closed form. We just solved it. Okay. If we wanted to write it kind of an impulse could write it this way as well. That's also a Z, you know, another way to write that ZV shaper. Okay. So, that's going to create zero vibration if the frequency of my system exactly matches the omega that I used in those equations. How often is that going to happen?
Never.
So we need to think about, well, maybe it creates zero vibration if we match exactly, but maybe it falls apart if we're wrong at all. So let's take a look at what happens if there's error in that frequency. Right? If we've picked the AI and TIs for a certain omega by solving this, and then the actual system I'm trying to apply it to has a different natural frequency. Okay. So let's put that here. Let's actually think about that. This will not be in the notes. Okay. So if I had the A1, and you create some vibration, if the frequency that I design A2 for is different than this actual frequency the thing oscillates at, what is that? How does that manifest itself in terms of the timing of A2? Okay, so when would be the exact wrong time to do this?
At the second point.
So you're saying if I put an impulse right there, and it's going to cause the exact same vibration, and that could be a problem. Okay, perhaps. Luckily, we have a constraint over here that's saving us from doubling vibration.
They have to equal 1.
So 1, right, neither one of these is 1. Like this would be, in this case, let's say 0.5. This is an undamped system. That's what the ZV shaper would work out to be. And remember, we're comparing to a unity magnitude impulse at time 0. Right. That's going to be already twice as large. So the worst I can do with the ZV shaper is the same amount of vibration I would have gotten if I didn't use the shaper at all. Absolute worst. That's a pretty good result. I can never get more vibration by applying ZB shaping to a system than I would have had without the shaper itself. That's pretty good. Let's look at that in a little bit more detail. So it's nice to have the upper bound. We're not going to... Can't go unstable. Can't force it unstable. Okay. Let's look at a tool we use in the input shaping world to look at how this response might change as the frequency changes. Okay. On the vertical axis, I'm going to write percent vibration, percent residual vibration. Okay. And really what is there is 100 times this equation. Right, it's just this equation, but written as a percentage. Right? So if you want to generate one of these curves, you just take that and plug it in for some range of frequencies. Okay. What we're going to do, though, is write the horizontal axis in terms of normalized frequency. And we're going to normalize so that we don't have to generate one of these for every different omega set we want to look at. And what we're going to do is take the actual natural frequency of the system and divide it by the frequency we use to design the shaper, omega m for omega modeled.
What vibration is that?
So we have this normalized frequency on the horizontal axis and the percent vibration, which is basically this vibration equation times 100 to get to a percentage from that kind of proportion. And so at 1 on this horizontal axis, what does that mean in terms of our model? It's perfect. Okay. So we just showed, hey, the ZV shaper, I got 0 right there. Okay. And what we'll see, I'm going to draw this up to, say, 30%. Okay. And we're going to do, let's do plus or minus 20. It's kind of an unheard of range for a feedback controller to work really well over that big a range of parameters. Right? But the RTV shaper, he doesn't do too bad. That's about right. So what is this plot telling us? As we move away, as the actual frequency of the system moves away from where we model it, what's going on? You get more residual vibration. That makes sense. Our model is worse. We're doing a little bit worse. But we get out and we're off by 20%. How much vibration do we get? 30% of what we had without shaping. So we're still reducing vibration 70%. From what we would have had if we didn't use the shaping stuff to generate our reference command. That's a pretty good result, too. All right. What you'll see, that's going to be 15. If you're looking, you know, working on this stuff maybe for research or something, quite often that VTOL line, in order to compare different types of shapers, you'll set VTOL to 5%. And then what we want to look at is the width of that, this curve that's below VTOL. Okay. And then for the ZV shaper, that's 0.06. So what we're saying here basically is about, it's not quite symmetric, but pretty close to it, about plus or minus 3% error. If I have plus or minus 3% error in natural frequency from what I designed for, I still get a 95% reduction in vibration from without using this input shaping stuff. I can quite often get this close. For cranes, I can almost always get this close to what the payload, the natural frequency is. Okay. So that number, let's get another color. That number there is called insensitivity. Okay. And at 5%, you'll see it written, which means the insensitivity of that shaper at a VTOL of 5%. And you can look at I of 10%, I of 15%, all these different things if you want. Basically, that insensitivity is a measure of what we would say is robustness of the shaper to modeling error. Okay. Where might this kind of insensitivity measure also be important? Any ideas? So one is just pure modeling error. I didn't get, you know, I'm trying to control this crane pendulum thing, and square root of G over L, and I get L wrong. Right. I measure L a little bit wrong.
Maybe if you have some kind of disturbance.
Not really, because remember, this is happening. We're designing this command outside of the feedback loop. Right? This is the reference going in.
You're talking about a crane, and you change the length of the cable.
What is change? Yeah.
Change the natural frequency.
Sure. So it also shows up if this natural frequency is not fixed for my given system. Right. So if I have a crane, right, it's basically a pendulum square root of G over L is the natural frequency. I start hoisting that crane up to move something. The L has changed. My frequency changed. So I might move outside of this range and start getting vibration. Or I have a robotic arm, right? It's going to have a higher frequency in close to its body than it does reaching really far out. Right? The moment of inertia is changing. Right? The denominator of my natural frequency would be changing. So the frequency is changing here. Right? So you get those kind of effects. You also get just other nonlinearity things that show up and kind of manifest themselves as varying frequency throughout your workspace. So this is not just a map of what happens when I have modeling error, but also kind of a map of how robust this kind of shaper would be to those kind of nonlinearities and those changes in my system. Maybe the system is actually changing. It's not that I just got it wrong. It's the system varies. So in that case, you know, this is a pretty good result. We might need more insensitivity. So what could I do? Do another shaper. Okay? What should it be?
Something the derivative of your...
The derivative? These guys are cheating. They work in my group. Okay. So what I'm going to say, okay, is, well, let me ask you this. I'm not sure you know this yet. Why would I want to take the derivative, right? We've said that the blue thing here, right, is just this vibration equation, right? And he's suggesting correctly that, hey, we can increase the robustness just by also enforcing a constraint on the derivative of that equation with respect to frequency. Kind of, yeah.
Putting the limit on how fast your frequency changes, right?
Okay, well, you're saying, what you said, set the derivative equal to zero, right?
Right.
So what does that do for a plot? A curve has a derivative of zero.
So you end up with...
Close. There you go. So if I take the derivative, right, this plot, this blue line is just that vibration equation. So if I take the derivative of it, with respect to frequency, right, and enforce it equal to zero at my design frequency, what I'm saying is, hey, I want it to be zero there because we're still going to enforce the zero constraint, but also have zero slope there. Okay. And I can do that and get a solution that looks something like that. And we'll talk about it in just a second. And we'll see that's going to be called the ZVD shaper for zero vibration and derivative. Okay. So we take our set of constraints we had over here for the ZV shaper, and we add one. Add in orange, maybe. The derivative of that equation with respect to frequency is also equal to zero. Okay. So ZVD shaper, zero vibration and derivative shaper. Because we've enforced the constraints that it has zero vibration at the design frequency, and the derivative is also zero. Okay. If I want to write that one, let's see, I can get rid of this maybe. Leave that equation up though. I can also write the ZVD shaper in that matrix form. Research. Didn't look right. That's what I thought. And the K is the same one over there in the corner. 2K, yeah. So we 1 over 1 plus K squared, 2K over 1 plus K squared, and then A3 is K squared over 1 plus K squared. So we know that solution. We can work through that solution, or you can work that solution if you want. And you can get this, the solution to the ZVD shaper in closed form as well. Right, which is nice.
So that's saying you use it three impulses instead of
two? Three impulses instead of two. Okay. So that's one penalty. We got a lot more robustness, right? And this is actually, I think I drew it a little bit too wide, but there's a pretty plot of it in the notes. Oops. It doesn't go way over there. So the ZVD has a 5% insensitivity of 0.29. And again, it's not quite symmetric, but it's about, you know, 14.5%, plus or minus 14.5%. Well, that's pretty close. So we got more robustness to changes in frequency. We said one penalty is that it has more impulses. What's the other penalty?
It takes
It takes longer. So look at the duration of this command. Right? This guy goes all the way to tau d. What's the duration of the ZV shaper? Tau d over 2. So what does that do for my response?
Slower.
And it's slower because the resulting shape command has a longer rise time. The command itself has a longer rise time. What does the shape command look like for this guy? If I had a step as the original command. So if I took my original step command, convolved it with this ZVD shaper. I have three steps now. If I'm convolved from my original commands of step input, right? Looks something like that. But the process to get to that shape command is the same as we walked through a week ago. Right? I would take the original command, multiply by the first impulse, do that at time 0. Take the original command, multiply by the second impulse, do that at time t2. The original command, multiply by the third impulse, do that at time t3. And then just add those together. Right. So that process of implementing these shapers is actually really simple. Okay. Let's see. We'll leave that up. We can get rid of this stuff, maybe. Sure, so now you're getting into a different kind of solution. So what you're talking about, what we would call initial conditions. So it's non-zero initial conditions. And if we know those, then we also can design this. Instead of designing vibration to be zero, we just design vibration to be opposite of what we just measured the initial condition to be. But more likely in that case, if you have non-zero initial conditions, you're going to be pushed towards using a feedback controller generally. Okay. So let's erase that. Get rid of that. And this. We need K to understand those. Okay. So, we're two of the most common input shapers. You guys are already experts. And more than most folks in the world do about this stuff. Okay. So, what's left? What else can I do? With shaping in general. Okay, so that's... What's that?
So far, we've only set it to zero.
So we've said back here even that, hey, I might not want to set it to zero always. Right? So far, we've set it to zero. Right? And to be actually zero, my design frequency, my design procedure has to exactly match the system I'm designing for. Does that ever happen? No. So am I ever going to get zero vibration intentionally? Exactly zero. No. Okay. So the kind of train of thought for this next type of shaper is, I basically from that perspective, I know I can never actually get zero, 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 like absolutely zero vibration. So if I relax this constraint that it be zero, does that help me at all? Yes. Why else are we talking about it, right? All right. So what we get...
Instead of your graph being 0 at 1, it would be whatever you set your tolerable level.
That's right. So let's say, hey, we're going to force it to be 5. So I'm going to say at my design frequency, let there be some amount of vibration. In this case, we're going to say, hey, VTOL is 5%, 0.05. And if we look at this solution, what happens... is that. Get this kind of hump in the middle. Okay. We'll label it for the plot right now and then talk about it. So this guy has an insensitivity of 0.3992. The offensive reported is 0.4. And it's called an EI shaper. Okay, let's look at our constraint set again. We'll say, well, that's kind of dumb to try to set it to zero, so don't do that. Let it be VTOL instead. And we'll say, make it less than or equal to VTOL just at the design frequency. Again, for vibration, this is the only constraint I'm enforcing, just still at this design frequency. Let it be VTOL. Okay, and if I do that, the kind of sensitivity curve that pops out looks like that orangish one. Okay, so what's the penalty for that? Let's see. This is our EI shaper. For undamped systems. Okay, so I set VTOL to 5%. The VTOL that goes in that equation would be 0.05. Represent 5%. So we see anything yet? Any penalty for this shaper?
It takes the same amount of time as
a DVD. Same amount of time as a DVD, but hey, I get a lot more robustness out. That's kind of a good result. I've given up trying to get zero, so that's maybe a downside. I don't know. Depends on your system. But I get way more insensitivity, way more robustness to errors in frequency for the same duration. Same rise time, same speed of response as the DVD. That's good. So that's good. Good, all good so far. Any penalties here? Why do you think I've only shown you the undamped one so far? Damping has a negative effect on it. I think it has a negative effect on our solution procedure. The undamped one is the only one we know in closed form for an EI shaper. So that is one downside to the EI. We have curve fits and nice, pretty precise curve fits for this for each one. So that's a little bit of a downside to this EI shaper. Right? Is that I really only know the closed form analytical solution for the undamped case.
So for the ZBD and ZB, the closed form solution works for damped cases as well?
Yeah, this includes damping, right? You got tau D, the K term has zeta inside it. So the closed form analytical solutions we've seen for ZV and ZVD apply for all natural frequencies and damping ratios. Underdamped, sorry. You get overdamped, these equations don't work anymore.
So, your VTOL, you're setting equal to or less than your percent residual vibration. Doesn't that also have damping in it somewhere?
So this is all assuming, if you go and try to solve this, plug for the solution, that zeta goes to zero. So you can solve this when zeta is zero. It's undamped. Right. Okay. So it's still, I think we're doing pretty good. I mean, the penalty for not knowing in closed form is actually not that large. I'm overselling that a little bit. Because we have really good curve fits in this, solving it numerically takes a split second. So it's not that big a deal, really, if we have to solve numerically. Okay. So there you have the three most common positive input shapers. We call them positive because we limited the impulse amplitudes to be positive. Okay. How else could we improve robustness or improve our method to generating robustness to changes in frequency? We could allow negative impulses. I'm going to say that doesn't have a ton of effect on the robustness near the design frequency. Right? The negative impulses we'll see on Thursday. We should get to those. Well, speed system response more than anything. They don't really offer us much more in terms of robustness. How have we achieved robustness so far? Has it been, let me ask a different way. Has it been an explicit part of our design procedure yet? No. Right? We just kind of tried things and, oh, we got more robustness by doing that. Right? Another method that what we'll do, I'll put it right here, is to take this sensitivity curve. I'm just going to call that vibe now, but it's still the percent vibration. Save us a little bit of writing. And we still have normalized frequency on the horizontal axis. And I'm going to set some VTOL. Okay. And now what I want to be able to do is explicitly define how much robustness I want or need for my system in some frequency range. How can I do that? I want to say, let's say, between there and there, the range of frequencies, I want vibration less than VTOL.
Assuming a constant VTOL, say 5%?
For now, we can. You don't have to.
So if you're not moving VTOL,
you want to say that you want less or equal to residual vibration than VTOL within a certain range, right? So can't you just set that range?
Range of what?
Your insensitivity. Basically, like, limit your insensitivity.
Yes, that's what we're trying to do. That's what I'm asking. How are we going to do that? How can we explicitly include, I want vibration less than VTOL over this whole range of frequencies? So far, where have we enforced the vibration equation, that tolerable vibration constraint?
In the residual vibration equation.
I mean, where in the frequency range?
At one.
Only at the design frequency. Okay, so okay, I want to enforce it there. I want V less than VTOL at that frequency.
I can enforce it elsewhere.
Okay, if I know I need it over this range, maybe I want it less than it over there. Maybe I want V less than VTOL over there at that frequency. So I'm going to say limit the vibration for frequencies omega k for k different frequencies within your range. Right, so before, we were just solving at 1. So now I'm saying, well, just apply this vibration constraint, not just there, but over here a little bit. And then over at the edge of your range, you want to limit vibration. And then over above it. And then at the top of the range, you want to limit vibration. Okay. And if you enforce that constraint at every one of these places in here, what does that mean for the vibration over the entire range? If you enforce that constraint and are able to get a solution, the constraint hold or not? It held, right? So if we are able to solve this problem, limiting vibration at k different points, inside our frequency range, we want vibration to be low, then vibration will be low over that entire range. Right? And quite often what you end up with are shapes that look like an EI shaper. They'll have humps and things like that in the range. Okay? Is a solution you'll get. Okay? How many different frequencies do I have to solve for to be able to guarantee that V is less than V tall over that entire range? Infinitely many. That's right. So to be able to guarantee that it's less than V tall over an entire range, I need infinite. K needs to go to infinity. Right? Because what could happen is I could have some solution that in here goes a little bit above. Because I haven't limited vibration at that point. So I need, in theory, infinitely many point sampling points in here. In practice, you don't need that many at all. Yeah, basically. If they're close enough together, there's not much it can do in between, kind of. Right? So in practice, we'll do 50 to 100 in a range. And you can get away with less than that, actually, but the cost of doing 50 or 100 is near zero in terms of the solution procedure. Okay. This method results in shapers called specified insensitivity shapers. And they call that because we are, by doing this, by solving this problem, we are including, we're specifying what the insensitivity should be for the solution. Right? We're saying it should be that, right? In this case. So the insensitivity becomes an explicit part of the solution that we're able to specify. Okay. We look back over to our constraints. Okay, some large number M. Where M, you know, in solving by hand actually doesn't need to be that many. If we're looking at the EI solution, you just need three and you get to the EI if you're trying to approach it from this perspective. But typically we'll see M ...50 to 100 points in a frequency range. It's more than enough. You think we know closed form solutions to this one? No, we don't know the closed form solutions. So that's the big downside to the specified insensitivity is that we actually have to solve this numerical optimization problem every time. But again, in practice, this is hit enter in Python and the answer will be there. It takes effectively zero time to do this problem is that simple. Okay. I should note also, I've kind of drawn this range here of symmetric. Doesn't have to be symmetric. So if you know, for example, that your frequency always changes in one direction, right? You have some kind of nominal operating point, maybe I'm near the ground with a crane, and my frequency, I can't hoist lower than that. Right? So nominal frequency is around the ground, but I do hoist up 2 meters sometimes. I can design my frequency range so that it's skewed towards those higher frequencies. So it doesn't have to be symmetric about your nominal value of natural frequency. I also can select multiple ranges here, right? So I could be between, you know, those two points and then between some other points way out here. And solve the numerical optimization, it works out. We get rid of both modes, both frequencies, ranges of frequency. Okay. So there's the core of positive input shaping. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you can only get the undamped case.
No, the damping is included.
I'm sorry, the unshaped case at worst.
Yes, you can. At worst, for positive, at any positive shaper, the worst you can do is the amount of vibration you would have gotten without the shaper. For any shaper that has just positive impulses, even SI. And that is one of the big strengths of this method. You can never do worse. Your model is completely wrong. The worse it can be, the worse you're going to do is, hey, if I didn't do it at all. Okay, so we got 5 minutes left. Let's talk about how we would actually do this on a real, quote unquote, real system. Right? Kind of talked through it a little bit already. So let's say I have my impulse sequence. In this case, let's say we have a ZV shaper. So what I'm going to draw there's our time, and each one of those ticks is our control loop, right? And we have a fixed control loop, right? It's a digital controller. We're doing stuff every mark. Okay. And I'm saying, well, I'm going to have a shaper that 1, 2, 3. It's 5 of my time steps long. Whatever actual time that ended up being. That's going to vary based on your system and time, you know, sampling time and all that for your control system. Okay. Okay. So at time step 1, time 0. My user, let's say, gives some input. All right, what do I do with that?
Multiply it by A1.
Multiply it by A1, which will be less than 1, so it's going to be a little bit smaller. Let's make these colors. Okay, and I do that right now, right? So 5 steps later.
Multiply it by A2.
I save the A2 part for 5 steps from now. Okay. Then my next input, my user says, hey, go a little faster. What do I do now?
Take that input at that time and multiply it by A1.
By A1 at this time. Okay. Wait 5 seconds, do A2. Right? And I'll keep marching through time like that. So let's just assume some inputs real quick so we can finish. When I get to them overlapping, I might be off by a time step over here. When I get to them overlapping, I just still do the blue right now, but I have that red in reserve from the first time step, from the first step over here. Let me draw a couple more steps and we can talk through that. So I started out saving that red for later. When I get over to a piece of time that had a red saved, I just add, you know, I'm going to have some current command there too. I take A1 times the command plus A2 times the command. That's all this is showing. Just add them together. Yeah, they just add together. It's like the, well, we erased it. Just like where the step starts happening. You have the first step. If you want to think about it this way, that this is kind of first step, order red start. That's kind of what's happening. That second step kicks in when they start overlapping in the step case. So for implementation, this is totally easy to do. Right? All I need to do is take whatever I'm measuring right now as my input, or giving right now as my input, multiply it, do that right now, multiply, save that for later. So I have a multiplication and an addition for each impulse in my sequence. That's nothing. Right? This is trivial for even the lowest powered computers out there to do in real time. So that's another big benefit of this method, is it's super easy to implement. Okay, questions about any of that? Okay, thanks.